Oh, I know Percy already talked to me, yeah. So. Well, at least the people who really care are here. And at least the people I really like are here. Those ones that aren't here, I don't like too much. I like Percy, okay. Definitely don't like him. Yeah, make sure that gets on the podcast, please. I definitely want that one on the podcast. Maya's not here, but I do like her. Who else? Where's Joey? Well, I did like him, but I don't anymore. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. How many do we have in this class? So we have 14 that are missing? Was it something I said? I think we have three courses that we're still working on, right, with me? I'm going to try to do one session from each of them today so we can advance a little bit. Where did we end in church history? We did. Don't tell me the page number. My pages did not correspond with yours. See how many notes I have? Because mine are 24-point font, too, so. Augustine, huh? Spring training began this week. I'm pretty excited about that. So the Cardinals had their first. You know, it started, catchers and pitchers reported February 15th, but we had our first preseason game was on their Monday, our Tuesday. So we've had two games. So looks like it's going to be a good year. I'm trying to find out. Okay, I think I got it now. No, I don't have it yet. Oh, Augustine, right? Is that where we ended? Did I say everything about him? How do you know? How do you know I did? What, Dar? I did? Did I give that next to the Apostle Paul? Did I talk about the city of God? Then I didn't finish everything. Did I talk about his mama? Monica? Prayed for him? Next to the Apostle Paul, Augustine did more to shape Christianity than any other person, laying the theological groundwork for the total Christian society. Two books that Augustine wrote that are probably two of the most, well, they would be in the top 10 most important books written in the history of the church. One is called Confessions, which is his story of his conversion. And it's unique in that the whole book is directed to God. So it's spoken to God as opposed to written to people. And it's all just in the form of a prayer. But it's his confession. It's the story of his life. But the most important book is called The City of God. The City of God. And in The City of God, he outlined a biblical view of history. And that there are two cities, essentially, that are living side by side. There's the city of man, and then the city of God. And so man advances his plan, his objectives, his purpose, and it looks like he's winning. It looks like the city of man is gaining the ascendancy. That's the primary thing in the world. But there's this other city, an invisible city, the city of God that's growing alongside of it. And it will continue to increase while the city of man will continue to decrease. And there'll come a time when the city of God or the glory of God will cover the earth like the waters cover the sea. And that book has been in continual print for 1,600 years. So it's never gone out of print. And it became the primary textbook that shaped the next 1,000 years. Everybody interacted with City of God in some way or another, and it became the primary framework from which theology was done. I wouldn't recommend trying to read it. It's pretty hard to read. I tried real hard. I wanted to say that I read it, but it beat me real bad. It pinned me. I gave up. But it's important to know about it. John Chrysostom is our next fella. Chrysostom, Chrysostom, was the greatest preacher of the Greek church. You know, there's two... Whoops. There. Oh, you want me to do it again?
Yeah.
I'll go real slow for some of the guys in the front row. C. Did you get that, King? C. H. R. Y. S. O. S. T. O. M. It actually, the Chrysostom is a nickname. It means golden mouth because he was a great preacher. Golden mouth. Yeah, Joseph.
I'm sorry to ask a question so early.
No, that's okay. That's the day. Makes it more fun.
Is the city of God theologically sound, like through and through? Because I've read some articles where people say a lot of the abuse of the church, particularly the Roman Catholic Church, was drawn from stuff that they read in the City of God.
Yeah.
And why is it that a lot of Christians now, it seems like the emerging church type, they don't like some of it. I don't know if I'm understanding it correctly.
Yeah.
But it seems like there's something about that book that people say hasn't produced good fruit.
Yeah. Well, you asked, is it theologically sound through and through? Of course, the only book that's theologically sound through and through is the Bible. Okay. Everything else is corrupt, influenced by our fallen nature. You can't completely judge a book by the misinterpretations that people get from it. I think there are some misinterpretations. I think the Roman Catholic hierarchy interpreted it as a manifesto for when we look at the papacy tries to exalt itself above all civil authority, then they may have quoted Augustine out of context. But to Augustine, the city of God is a spiritual city.
Okay.
To the Roman church, the city of God became a political organization,
okay,
ecclesiastical political organization. And so it certainly was taken out of context and misused. Yeah. Good question. John Chrysostom, golden mouth, he opposed the allegorical interpretation of Scripture and promoted the grammatical historical method of biblical exegesis. I don't want to go into that too much. That's a whole course. But there was a method of interpreting the Bible that became predominant actually for about 1,000 years called the allegorical approach, which the early church had a difficult time figuring out how to understand the Old Testament. because there's been a severing of their relationship with Judaism. And so they don't want to deal with it just on a historical basis because they've really separated themselves from Judaism. And you know, there's some difficult parts in the Old Testament that are hard to explain and to understand. And so the primary method of interpretation then is they said, let's not deal with the historical aspect of the Old Testament, but actually it's hidden symbols and pictures. So they began looking for symbolic meaning in every single thing and discounted the historical account and just looked for mystical hidden pictures. Now, it was Chrysostom who resisted that and stood for what we call a grammatical, historical, or we call it the literal approach, which is that's the approach that we believe and teach. And so Chrysostom was one of the main early advocates for the idea that the plain words of Scripture are true and the meaning is contained in their grammatical construction, the historical context, etc. Not some kind of hidden mystical meaning that you had to have the right key to be able to unlock and interpret. Now, unfortunately, we'll talk about Chrysostom later, but he is one of the main people that begin to speak very negatively against the Jews and Judaism. And this is the beginning of antisemitism. You familiar with the term antisemitism? Semite, of course, come from the name Shem, right? The son of Noah that the Hebrew nation came from. So a Semite is a Jew, and anti-Semitic is hatred of the Jews, organized official hatred of the Jews. And Chrysostom is one of the early proponents of that, unfortunately. Leo the Great is number six and our last one. Leo the Great, he established the seed, S-E-E, that's not a typo. C is the technical word for a bishopric, the territory that a bishop overseas. It's called a see, S-E-E. He established the see, or the geographical location that the Roman bishop had oversight over, as the pinnacle of ecclesiastical authority, declaring that resistance to his authority was the sure way to hell. Obedience to the Pope was necessary to salvation. So I think when we come to Leo, we can definitely start talking about popes now. So I think we probably would consider Leo the first pope. But at this point, the Roman Church has gotten to the place that we really do have what they claim the Pope has. We have one person who's in charge of Christendom. He thought he was, and he did his best to make sure everybody else thought he was. So, first pope. Okay, can we move on then? We're into a new chapter, right? Yeah, session five. Christianity planted among the nations. We got a big gap of time here, 591, 1049. The missionary endeavor and conversion of the nations. Number one, the missionary labor of the Middle Ages was a process of converting nations through spiritual means, political influences, and in some cases, military force. Now, the first missionaries, we see some of the first missionaries in the New Testament. We see some of the first missionary activity, and certainly there was quite a bit of missionary activity that we don't know about that took place. We're almost certain that Thomas made it to India and planted a church there, and that churches were planted. The original apostles and early missionaries went to a lot of different places. But generally where they're going into the Roman Empire, we have established civilizations. And so it's a little different when you're going to start a church in a place where there's always already a civilization established. There's a legal process. There's a political system. There are courts. There's a system of transportation and agriculture. But in 476 AD, Rome is conquered by the barbarians, and the Roman Empire in the West falls. And a sort of political darkness then spreads across all of Europe. And almost overnight, these barbarians invade most of Europe. And now missionaries going, there's no established political system. You're not going to establish cities. Now you're going to essentially barbarians and nomadic tribes, etc. So it's a completely different kind of missionary activity. Now you're not only having to go and bring the gospel, but the first missionaries began to, they had to create an alphabet because there was no written language. There was no literature. So in order to teach people the Bible, they don't even have a language that you could interpret the scriptures into. So these monks have to create language. I mean, they have to write, they actually get the sounds and create a whole written language so the Bible can be interpreted, and then teach people how to read and write to understand the scriptures. So they're not only bringing the gospel, but really they're bringing civilization during this period of time. And also because things are changing in the church and we're definitely losing our influence on the gospel, and it's all about externals. Some of this conversion takes place because people really hear the gospel and are converted. But some of it happens, a large amount of it happens, because their missionary strategy is they'd go to the ruler, convert him, and then he would mandate that everybody in his nation had to be baptized. Whatever you were before, you are now a Christian. And so you just get an order. The king's been baptized as this new religion, Christianity, so we got to show up at the church on something they call Easter or something, and we have to be baptized, and now we call ourselves Christians. And so whole nations were baptized into the Christian church, but they had no clue, no idea at all what's going on. And sometimes if they resisted, then conversion took the next step. So like, first we preach the gospel to you, and if you don't respond that way, then the king commands you. And then if you don't respond, then we just kill you. Yeah, so you don't want to repent? Fine, put your head on that block of wood. Next! Okay, I'll convert. Yeah, so this is our legacy, folks. These are our forefathers. We'll look at some of the significant nations. England is our first. The missionary history of Great Britain is divided into two periods, the Celtic and the Anglo-Saxon. How the gospel first came to England, we're not sure. But it certainly came there early. Now, Rome had already come to England. Actually, Julius Caesar in 55 BC invaded England and had moved considerably north. However, he couldn't hold it, and so he retreated. But by 33 AD, which is 3 years after the resurrection, the city of Londinium is established, which of course is our modern day London, as a Roman outpost. So the Romans are in London and southern England about the time of Christ. And certainly missionaries began coming to England very early on. And who was the first? English people have claimed throughout the years that the Apostle Paul was the first missionary. They claimed that it was Peter, Philip, John, or probably the most popular is Joseph of Arimathea. Remember Joseph of Arimathea? He's the guy who had the tomb, right? And he volunteered to have Jesus put in his tomb. But Joseph of Arimathea, he shows up in the Arthurian legends. You know King Arthur? You heard of King Arthur, right? And the Knights of the Round Table, which is basically a Christian myth. And according to that, it was Joseph of Arimathea who comes and brings the gospel to England. Actually, in some of the legends, Joseph of Arimathea is the uncle of Jesus, and he brings the young Christ to England when he's 10, 11, 12, 13, something like that. And there are whole myths and legends that grew up about that. And there is some fascinating historical connections. Glastonbury is supposedly Avalon, or was Arthur's, was the center of his kingdom. And I've been to Glastonbury and looked at some of the historical sites and examined some of the information. And there's some interesting things. There's a particular plant that only grows around Glastonbury, and only one other place in the world is around Jerusalem. So it only grows in those two places, Jerusalem or in Palestine and around the area of Glastonbury. So supposedly it's because Joseph of Arimathea and Jesus brought this plant when they came and planted it. And all kinds of fascinating mythology centered around that that we'd have a lot of fun talking about, but really has no value whatsoever in what we're trying to accomplish. But it is fascinating. There is a possibility that the Apostle Paul actually got there. Clement, writing in 95 AD, Clement was Paul's disciple. Clement's referred to in Philippians chapter 4, verse 3. And he wrote a letter to the Corinthians in 95 AD, and we have a copy of it. It still exists. And in it, he says that the Apostle Paul completed his mission by preaching the gospel to the uttermost west. Now, at that point, of course, Great Britain was as far west as you could get, and it was a part of the Roman Empire. So some people have speculated that Paul got that far, but probably he's referring to Spain. If you remember the book of Romans, Paul wanted to come to Rome in order to use Rome as a jumping off point to go preach the gospel to Spain. So it's most likely that's referred to. So we don't know how the gospel comes to England at first. Probably some of the Roman soldiers who are being converted get saved, or there's a lot of trade that's taking place between England and the continent, and it's established there. But early on, the peoples of England are the Celts. The Celts are the native people there. And the Celts, you probably know about the Druids, right? Have you heard about Druids? And do you know Stonehenge? Yeah, you know, I mean, it's usually that's the iconic picture of England. They show the monument of the stones. And I've been to Stonehenge several times. And I remember my first time, I was extremely disappointed because in the pictures, it looks massive. When you get there, pretty disappointing. Yeah, it's just not near as, like, I'm thinking, wow. But, you know, it is taller than that ceiling, but it's not a whole lot taller. Yeah, so, I mean, I was really hoping to be wowed, but I wasn't. Joseph?
Isn't there some kind of loose connection between the Celts and the Celtics? Like, that's what they originally started, like, they were trying to identify themselves with, right?
You mean who? What Celtics? You mean
the Boston Celtics?
Yeah. Well, Celtic is just the word Celtic is just the bad pronunciation of Celt. So yeah, because the Irish are a Celtic people, and the Irish came to Boston. It is with a C, yeah. Celt, but Americans pronounce it with a soft S. Yeah, it's just a bad pronunciation. So, you know, the Boston Celtics, you know, he's a leprechaun, you know, with a shamrock. So that's the Celtic people or the Irish people. So the Celtic people still are the Welsh, the Irish, and the Scottish. Those are the original inhabitants. And so the gospel is firstly a Celtic gospel. It comes to the Celts, and they're animistic as far as, you know, they're pagans or druids. And the gospel penetrates to the Celts, and a rich Christian Celtic heritage develops that is still in existence in various parts of England to this day. It's a little bit more mystical. It's not hierarchical, so it's devoid of hierarchical structures and very much into spiritual pursuits and meditation and separated lifestyles and things like that. But when Rome's invaded the first time in 410 AD, and so all of the Roman legionnaires in England are recalled to Rome, and the nation is left unprotected. And so several Germanic tribes, barbarian tribes, the Angles, the Saxons, the Frisians, the Jutes, etc., they begin to look at this land, which is rich and ripe for the taking. And so the Anglo-Saxon raids begin in the 4th century and then begin to escalate. And so these Angles and Saxons, these Germanic pagan peoples, they come and they just rape the nation. They're like the precursors of the Vikings. So anything you think about Vikings, these are Angles and Saxons. And they completely destroy the church. Just kill all the ministers and destroy all the houses of worship. And there's not much left. It becomes a pagan, Germanic sort of worshiping Thor and Odin and the pagan gods of North Germany. But Pope Gregory, now looking at your note here, Pope Gregory sent the Benedictine abbot Augustine, not to be confused with Augustine that we talked about earlier, although the names are spelt the same and can be pronounced the same. We usually designate them by talking about Augustine as Augustine of Hippo. Remember, that was the place in North Africa that he was the bishop of. And Augustine of Canterbury, which is the headquarters of the English church. So he sends his abbot Augustine to evangelize the Anglo-Saxons in 597. King Ethelbert, one of the pagan kings of Kent, met the strangers and listened to them preach. He was converted and baptized and gradually drew his whole nation after him. Gregory was a fascinating guy. Before he became the pope, he was in the Roman slave market, and he saw three Anglo-Saxon children, 12, 13, 14-year-old children, being auctioned off for slavery. Now, the Anglo-Saxons are generally very fair-skinned. You know, they're like Nordic kinds of people. So blonde hair, fair skin, usually blue eyes, right? It's the Aryan race. Are you familiar with Hitler's desire to have a pure Aryan race? So blonde hair, blue eyes, etc. And so he sees these children that they really stand out in the slave market, and because they're very light skin, blonde, very striking blue eyes, they fetch a high price. And so he asks them where they're from and what their nationality is, and they said they're Angles, which sounded to him like angels. He said, "Yes, you are the angels of God. And where are you from?" Well, they were from one of the seven Saxon kingdoms of England called Deira, D-E-I-R-A, which in Latin, Ira, means wrath. And D is a prefix that means to get rid of wrath. So he said, yes, because the wrath of God will be lifted from your nation. And then he said, and who is your ruler? Well, their queen was a woman by the name of, it sounded like Iella, which sounded very much like the Latin hallelujah. And Gregory said, yes, the praises of God will sound from your nation. And that became God's voice to him. We need to go and evangelize, and God's going to do a great work there. And so he got ready to go, but before he could go, he became the pope. So one of his first jobs is, we're going to send missionaries to the Angles and the Saxons, and we're going to start a church there. So he against his will, he gets this guy Augustine and says, and you're going. Well, Augustine doesn't want to go, but you just don't tell the Pope no, okay? And so he takes off, and he gets as far as Gaul, which is modern-day France, and he hears these terrible stories about the Angles and the Saxons and their brutality and what they do to missionaries and all these terrible tortures. And he says, I'd rather face the wrath of the Pope. So he turns around. But when he gets back to Rome, he realizes, no, that was a bad choice. It's better to have your head cut off than have the Pope mad at you. So he starts back. And he crosses the English Channel north of Dover. And there's still a monument, a marker to the place where he came. And that's the Kent southeast corner of England. And the king is in Canterbury. And he hears about this guy, so he has him come, and he listens to him preach. Now, here's the amazing thing. I want to just show you God's providence, even in our fear and even in our disobedience. In between the time, Augustine would have made it to England had he not turned around in fear and cowardice. And the time he actually made it, Ethelbert's queen, named Bertha, got saved. Because her cousin was the queen of one of the kingdoms in France, and she'd been converted and preached to her sister. So Bertha's saved now and trying to preach to her husband. So because of that, when Augustine comes, the king doesn't kill him, you know, because he doesn't want his wife mad at him. You know, because when mama's mad, when she's not happy, nobody's happy. And so he brings him, listens to him, he gets converted. And he says, all right, everybody's getting converted. And on Easter Day, 598, there is a massive baptismal. 10,000 people are baptized right there in Canterbury. Canterbury is to this day still the headquarters of the Anglican or the English Church. So the Archbishop of Canterbury is the most powerful person in the Anglican Church. And I've been to Canterbury several times and been to Augustine's grave site and the monastery that he built there. And so from there, the evangelization of England moves on from that spot right there. All right, Ireland. The former slave Patrick was the apostle to Ireland. You've heard of St. Patrick, right? St. Patrick's Day, yeah. Which is most famous in the U.S. That's the day you get really drunk. Yeah, spring break usually coordinates with. In the city of Chicago, which has a huge Irish population, the Chicago River that runs through the city, they dye it green. The river is green on St. Patrick's Day. So mostly when you think about St. Patrick's Day, that's the day to really, really get drunk as opposed to the other days where you just sort of get drunk. But he's a great, godly man. Patrick, and the Irish don't like to acknowledge this, but he's not Irish at all, he's English. If you know anything about the animosity between the Irish and the English, that's not a point you want to bring up to your Irish friends. His father is a church elder. And Patrick grows up, he's a church kid. Everything that means, right? He's not rebellious. He's not resisting. But, you know, mom and dad go to church, and so he's kind of, you know, it's obligatory, so he goes to church, but there's no real hard faith. But this is, you know, we're talking 389, probably. He was born 461. So the barbarian tribes are coming, the Angles and the Saxons, and they're pirates. So he lives near the coast, and these pirates raid. They kill his mother and father. They rape his sister and take her into captivity. And they take him, and they sell him into slavery. And he ends up in Ireland as a slave. Well, how many know things like that have a tendency to get us a little bit more serious about the gospel? And so he begins to cry out to God and has a real genuine conversion experience. He's born again in captivity. And while he's in captivity, he has a dream. And in this dream, God shows him a method, a path to escape, to get out of slavery and to get back. He shows him who to talk to and how to do it and the path to go. And so he escapes from his captives and he ends up back in his native England, rescued by God. And he goes to the continent, he gets trained, and he becomes a priest, and now he's, you know, preaching the gospel in England. And he has a dream one night where he hears this person called Victorious, and he hears the Irish children calling out to him. He sees this massive group of Irish children calling out to him in the dream, saying, "Walk among us once again." And so he realized God is calling him back to go to that nation and preach the gospel. Now, the Druids have a stronghold on Ireland, and they practice human sacrifice, and they're just brutal people. So he goes back knowing what he's facing. I mean, I guess it would be, we were talking yesterday in the meeting about some areas in southern Mindanao that are big terrorist. What were those three cities? I couldn't remember. Yeah. You know, it'd probably be similar or even more intense than going into a place like that.
Joseph. Yeah, or we've got islands too that are dominated by witchcraft.
Yeah.
Like Sikihor, and if you go there, like, you better be prepared for spiritual warfare.
Yeah, very similar. So he goes and he challenges the Druid priests, sort of like an Elijah, prophet of Baals kind of thing. So let's get it on right here. We're going to see who is God. Has this big challenge with him, and the Druid priest back down, and Patrick goes throughout the whole nation preaching the gospel, establishing monasteries, and really from Ireland, the gospel spreads throughout most of Northern Europe. And really, it's because of the Irish monasteries that all of the early church writings that would have been lost in the fall of Rome, we can read Eusebius and we can read the early church fathers because the Irish, they maintained these manuscripts. And so really, the Irish saved the world. That's a fact that they like to remind you of. There's actually a book by a noted historian called Thomas Cahill called How the Irish Saved Civilization. And it's a history of Patrick and what happened, the revival that took place in Ireland as a result of his dedication to go into a very difficult area. He said, I think this is on your notes, I am a great debtor to God who has bestowed his grace so largely upon me that multitudes were born again to God through me. The Irish, who never had the knowledge of God and worshipped only idols and unclean things, have lately become the people of the Lord and are called sons of God. Less than a century after Patrick's death, Ireland was covered with churches and monasteries training missionaries and transcribing sacred books. So it's really one of the great stories in church history of a man had an amazing encounter with God and went in a very difficult place but believed for God's power, and the nation really was converted and transformed by the preaching of one man. And not only just the nation, but from there missionaries started going out, as we'll look at. Number four on our list is during the 6th and 7th century, Ireland sent missionaries to Scotland, England, France, Germany, Switzerland, and Italy. And one of those would be, number four, look at Scotland. In 563, Columba, is that your fill-in? Columba? C-O-L-U-M-B-A. Sailed from Ireland with 12 disciples to the west of Scotland. He was presented with the inhospitable island of Iona. From there proceeded the Christianization of Scotland. We call Columba the Apostle of Scotland. My heritage, my mother's side, is Scottish. And so I'm interested in Columba. He went to this island called Iona, which is, it's 3 miles long and less than half a mile wide. And it's a tidal island. Do you understand the idea of a tidal island? Tidal island is one that's close to the mainland, or actually close to another large island. And at different times of the day, it's an island. At different times of the day, it's actually connected to the mainland. Does that make sense to you? So when it's a low tide, you could walk across. At high tide, you have to swim across or take a boat. So it's just very inhospitable. Not much grows there. Not a really nice place. West Scotland is subject to some brutal cold winds coming off the North Irish Sea there. And they started this community with just 12 monks. And from there proceeded the evangelization of all of Scotland. And actually, we were talking about Augustine, who started in southern England. Iona then comes down from the north and evangelizes the northern part of England. So the island of Iona is still a monastery there. There's still a Christian community. There's been a Christian witness on that island since 563. It's one of the goals of my life to go there and visit on a pilgrimage one day. I hope to make it to Iona. I've already plotted my course. I'll get there one day. Columba, he's going one day to the northern part of Scotland to preach to one of the kings. And the Scots there, they're brutal people. Okay, if you've seen Braveheart, okay, it makes the Scots look good. We appreciate that, but really not true. They're just brutal people. Matter of fact, they were so brutal, the Romans couldn't conquer them. I mean, the Romans came north, and they were just too brutal. They beat the Romans. So what the Romans did is they built this wall across England to protect themselves from the Scots. It's called Hadrian's Wall. It was 73 miles. It goes from the Pacific Ocean on England on one side to the Atlantic on the other. The West Atlantic to the other side. Completely transverses the whole island. It was a massive wall. They had forts every mile along the way and completely manned. And I've walked on Hadrian's Wall. There's still parts of it that are in existence to this day. It was built in 126 AD to protect them from the Scots because they're so brutal. So, I mean, we're talking about, if you think about the most brutal headhunting, cannibalistic tribes that any missionary has ever gone to in the history of missions, we're talking about, that's my heritage, that's the Scots. That's why half of my family, you know, on my dad's side, were English, so we're Angles and Saxons, you know, we're Germanic people, so we're Stoics, we don't show a lot of emotion. And then on the Scottish side, we're Celt, so, you know, we scream and yell a lot, and I'm really conflicted, you know, not exactly sure which direction to go. So he's going to the north, and have you heard of the Loch Ness Monster? Right, so a loch, L-O-C-H, is a Scottish word for a lake. And so the Loch Ness, or the Ness Lake, is a very long, it's like a long finger, almost like just a really, really wide river because it's so long. And so he is on the southern end, and he's taking a boat up to the north to preach to the king, who's at the northern part of it. And this is the first recorded sighting of the Loch Ness Monster. So it's in Columba's journals that the monster came up out of the sea and took one of his missionary companions from the boat, grabbed him and started to eat him, and started to swim away with him. And Columba rebuked the Loch Ness Monster and commanded him to let go of his companion, and he did. The companion swam back. And Columba recorded. So it's the first recording. There was no legend. It starts there with Columba. So, and you know he wouldn't tell a lie. I mean, there's something in that lock, okay? There's something there. And it's been there for a long time. It's probably the great-great-great-great-great-great-grand monster of the one that Columba rebuked. But that's the first time. And he just took authority in the name of Jesus. It wasn't called the Loch Ness Monster at that time, but he commanded him, let him go, and he did, and he just went on to victory. So, Joseph.
This is the verified journal of Columba?
Yeah. These are his writings.
Like, along with everything else. It would be like, you know, the Confessions of St. Augustine and somewhere along the way.
Like, today, preach to the kings, converted. Rebuke the Loch Ness Monster. Yeah. Huh? Don't you believe me, babes? Is it? It's fascinating, isn't it? Yeah.
I always thought it was just someone's imagination? Because the first photograph is a fake, right?
Well, I don't know. I mean, Columba didn't take a photograph, so we don't know.
Is he related to Puff, the magic dragon? I'm just kidding.
Okay, Puff, yeah. Yeah, I just thought you'd be interested in that, so. Yeah, that's a fascinating story. I wrote, if you go to my website, there's a whole blog I wrote on the Loch Ness Monster and Columbus encounter with him. So, France is next. France, the Franks were the first of the Germanic tribes converted to Orthodox Christianity. So, do you remember, no, we haven't got to this part in systematic theology yet. No, maybe we have. Remember the Arian controversy, Arius and the Council of Nicaea? Yeah, we did get to the Council of Nicaea. Remember, Arius believed that Jesus was a created being. Right? Yeah, like, not the same as. So the Arians, you know, they would come and go depending on the emperor. Some of the emperors were Arian, some weren't. But they were fairly missionary-minded. And so the Arian missionaries traveled through some of the Germanic tribes, and they converted a large number of the Germanic tribes were actually Arian. So some of the Germanic tribes that came and conquered Rome actually were semi-Christian in that they were Arians as opposed to just pure pagans. And the Franks were generally Arian, but they were the first tribe that was actually converted to Orthodox Christianity. Although that's about the last revival that's taken place in France. When you look at the history of Europe, revivals in just about every location except France. I mean, Irenaeus, of course, he had a great work there in the middle of the 3rd century. But since that time, not much has happened. France is still one of the most difficult, hardest places to actually plant gospel Christianity in the world to this day. Germany, number 6. Boniface is our fellow, B-O-N-I-F-A-C-E. Boniface, you're familiar with that name, right? Boniface. Is that a common name in the Philippines? No? Bonifacio, yeah, okay, that's right. Duh. Was born in a noble English family. Now, he's English. Remember, English now, the word England comes from Anglo-Saxon, you know, the pagan tribes, so the Germanic tribes. That's why English, the English language, is a Germanic language. So the English language is most closely related to German. All of the English language, our framework, our structure, is all Germanic. A lot of the words have come in from Latin and from French, etc., but the structure is Germanic. And so Boniface is an Englishman, and a wealthy Englishman, but he felt it was his duty to Christianize those countries from which his Anglo-Saxon ancestors had emigrated. So he sacrificed his prospects at home, crossed the channel, and began his missionary career with a few companions. Now, these Germanic tribes had come to England. Many of them had been converted. There's gospel activity, but back in Germany, it's wild, pagan. If you've seen the movie Beowulf, that's kind of you think like Beowulf, you know, worshiping the pagan gods, the Greek gods of Norse mythology, Odin, Thor. Did you see the movie Thor? Right, so anyway. It was a good precursor to the Avengers. Yeah. Can't wait for that. And so they're still in pagan darkness. So Boniface says, well, it's our duty to go back to those people and bring the gospel to them. So he says, okay, we're going back. And so he begins to challenge the pagan religion of Germany. And he starts to build this church, and he starts to preach the gospel. And what he does is he goes, there's a sacred oak. If you know anything about pagan religions, they're into trees. right? So at various trees, special trees have special magical power, right? You saw Avatar, right? So that's a whole pagan concept of mystical power in trees. And there was this particular oak. It was the oak of Thor. And Boniface thought, well, the best way to challenge paganism, let's go straight to that oak. Let's have a church service. Let's preach the gospel. And at the end, let's cut it down. Let's chop the dang tree down. And say, I mean, that's like we're throwing the gauntlet down, man. It's us against you. This is Elijah challenging the prophets of Baal. And so all the pagan priests are there, and he just takes a big old hatchet, and he starts cutting the thing down. And, of course, Thor is the god of thunder. Yeah, thunder and lightning. So the pagans know what's going to happen. Thor is going to defend his sacred tree. So they start to back up and look to the sky because they're expecting thunderbolts, man. And Boniface just keeps chopping, chops the whole tree down. And then they start cutting up the tree and they use the wood from that tree to build the first church. No lightning, no thunder, no Thor. And the it was a powerful gospel sermon. And so many pagans start to come into the kingdom of God. Although he is eventually martyred, he's murdered on Pentecost while he's preaching. These pagans come into church and kill him in cold blood right in the middle of his sermon. Yeah. That's preaching right to the death. All right? You know, this seems like a really good place to end, so...